funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If it's inevitable for parents to sometimes worry when their teenagers are out, it's also inevitable they will breathe a sigh of relief when those teens get home. Within our sight, we assume they can't get into too much trouble. Except they can. They can bully or be bullied, sexually harass or be harassed, watch degrading pornography, experience crushing peer pressure, and send or receive nude images of people they know personally, all while sitting next to you on the living room couch. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The miraculous tools of the digital age, computers and tablets and smartphones, mean that young people can be simultaneously physically safe and emotionally and morally at risk. Journalist Nancy Jo Sales spent 2.5 years collecting the stories of teenage girls in particular all over America. She shares what she learned in her new book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Nancy Jo, welcome to Think.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. So boys and girls have access to, by and large, the same technology. Why is it that cyberbullying and cyber victimization are more prevalent among girls?
That's a very good question. When I talk to all these girls, more than 200 across 10 states in 30 months, I was really surprised to find how many of them had been cyberbullied. I didn't talk to really a single girl who hadn't experienced cyberbullying at some level. I think that we tend to think that cyberbullying has been dealt with or it's gone away. President Obama did a video about the cyberbullying of gay youth and told everyone it gets better. And so we think, oh, well, you know, that's sort of done. It's not. It's a terrible, terrible problem in the lives of girls. And I think the studies bear out that girls are targeted more often for cyberbullying. And I think that it has everything to do with what I only could call sexism, because they're cyberbullied for their gender. They're called names that are degrading to both women and girls. They're cyberbullied for their sexual activity or lack of sexual activity. They're called sluts and prudes and, you know, a host of other names. Whether it's just a small snarky comment on a picture that makes them feel bad that day, or in very extreme cases, which I do interview girls who are in those scenarios in my book, including attempts at suicide, it can be, you know, sort of this ongoing harassment that can last over days, weeks, months, that leads them to a point of desperation.
And I guess it's this idea that, you know, because of the pervasiveness of the internet, you know, the next time they show up at school, surely if it's not actually true, it feels like everyone in the school knows their shame.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's on social media.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is on it. And this goes across socioeconomic lines, race, you know, sexual orientation, gender identities. I speak to girls of all backgrounds in my book. And again, studies show us that kids have smartphones. Kids are on social media. Girls are using it more than anyone. And so whatever is out there, they see, because everyone is part of it. It's their culture, and they're all part of this ongoing conversation. So anything that happens to anybody is immediately sometimes relayed to everyone else.
So I read this figure in the book, but I'm going to make you say it out loud because it's really hard to fathom, Nancy Jo. How much time does the average American teenage girl spend engaging with media in a typical day?
Well, all teenagers, per studies, spend 9 to 11 hours a day on some kind of media, consuming either social media or some kind of media. In other words, on a screen of some kind, a computer, an iPad, a phone, a smartphone. That's a lot of screen time.
When are they sleeping?
Well, again, we're finding that they're not sleeping enough. Mm-hmm. In many cases. It's keeping them up at night. You know, it's very addictive, and girls repeatedly use the words, I'm addicted, it's addictive, I feel obsessed, I'm obsessing. And I think this is something a lot of adults can relate to, too. We're seeing this in our own lives. You know, I've noticed even in my own behavior, I have my phone, I'm checking my phone all the time. What is it about this technology and about these social media apps that make them so plug into our brains in this way? Well, for teenagers, and particularly teenage girls, it seems to be even more alluring because it's all wrapped up in this popularity contest that high school has always been, is now located on social media. So they are using it sometimes even when they go to bed, checking things, texting under the covers at night. I heard lots of stories of that, and not getting enough sleep.
It's interesting because, you know, when you and I were teenagers, if you were on the phone, your parents would sort of hear you through the door and say, hang that thing up and go to bed. It's really easy for a parent to assume a child is asleep when, in fact, they're up for hours more.
Yeah, it's true. And sometimes parents are not aware. Sometimes they try and institute rules about, well, you have to put your phone away at a certain hour. And, you know, I heard about one girl, her mother told me that it was the rule that she would have to plug it into the charger in the kitchen at 8 o'clock at night. But then they were finding that she would just go and sneak it into her bedroom after hours.
Hmm. Bullying aside, it's distressing to see how much importance girls place on likes and, you know, approval icons for their sense of self-worth. It's just hard to know if this will continue or if it's something they will maybe outgrow once their adolescence is over.
Well, it's something that major corporations bank on too.
Yeah.
You know, it's the way that we sell products now, the way that companies sell products and market things is through social media as well. And they bank on these likes as well. It's become a kind of currency, right? And what was so striking in talking to girls, as you read in my book, is they talk about using the exact same principles of marketing themselves and their social media pictures that companies use. In other words, posting certain times of day, posting certain kinds of pictures as to other ones, you know, looking for that sort of locale or location which will promote more likes and followers and so forth. You know, this restaurant, I know people like this restaurant, so if people see me eating lunch here, I mean, this is exactly what corporations do to promote their brands. Hmm. And so I think we really have to think about the way in which childhood has been overtaken by a certain kind of self-promotion and self-marketing through social media, and how this is challenging to an authentic childhood, the development of an authentic self.
You actually have a teenage daughter yourself, which has to be especially terrifying to do so much reporting on these trends. You can't have the illusion that this stuff is only happening somewhere else. You've seen it everywhere.
I have a teenager who's 15. She was around 12 when I first started doing the first story that I reported for Vanity Fair, which led to the book. And she did not have a phone at that point. And I'm very grateful that my life turned in this course where I was, you know, became so immersed in this reporting, because it enabled me to be aware of things as a parent that I probably wouldn't have known about otherwise, and that are in the book, and I hope other parents can find useful to read about, because it's helped me so much in knowing really what this culture of social media is all about and how it affects girls in particular, girls and boys. I mean, the book is called American Girls, but it's about boys too and boy culture as well. And how boys and girls interact in the new age of social media. But it's been so useful to me as a parent to be able to have this awareness and to have these conversations with her about what's going on with kids.
I want to talk about sexting. I think many parents would be shocked to think that their sons and daughters are even exposed to the kinds of graphic conversations and photographs that circulate among even very young teenagers. How did the teens that you interviewed feel about the ubiquity of sexting? Did they find it shocking?
Well, it depends what context or what scenario you're really talking about. Sexting means, as we know, the exchange of sexual or sexualized words or images, right? Mm-hmm. The minimizing view of sexting is that it's simply a new kind of virtual flirting, that it's a healthy exploration of sexuality, that it's just a new way that kids are flirting with each other. I don't really buy that, considering what I've heard from so many girls in so many places, because unfortunately, this is not face-to-face communication. This is not something that happens between two people in the moment, you know, where you're exchanging a kind of moment together. This is something that happens very often with other people involved. Hmm. And it's not necessarily intimate in the sense that we think of an intimate moment between two people who are developing a relationship. It's often performance, which can get screenshotted, sent around, viewed by others, non-consensually shared in ways that are sometimes very damaging. You know, one of the things that a lot of people have been shocked, it seems, to find out in the book is the prevalence of what's called slut pages. These existed in every community that I went to, almost every school, almost every girl had either seen a slut page or known about one in her community. And this is, if your listeners don't know already, it's an aggregated group of nudes or semi-nudes, which are put together typically by a boy, not always by a boy, but usually by a boy. And usually the pictures are nudes or semi-nudes of girls, not always, but mostly. And it's put up on Facebook or Instagram or one of these places and one of these apps or sites. And people see it, you know, and it sometimes takes a few days for it to get taken down. And they often have degrading names. They have, you know, names like in Boca Raton, it was Boca Hotties or something like that. And the girls, you know, they see this happening and they know that it happens. And there's a feeling of threat associated with it, that it can happen and that there's no punishment or recourse for it, because very often it goes just unremarked upon by the administration of their school or by adults. You know, it just sort of like comes and goes and it's just sort of in the atmosphere.
One would think that knowing that that existed would be a real deterrent to taking any kind of, you know, revealing photograph of yourself or letting someone else take one of you or dealing with someone else's. Do girls feel pressured to provide these images of themselves?
Yeah. And there was a study just recently that said something like, I don't want to quote the number wrong, but a high percentage of girls have felt pressure to send nudes at some point. And there's studies about that in my book as well. And girls tell me about that. The opening scene of my book, the first line of my book as you get into the chapters is send nudes. And this is a request or demand that's been sent by a boy to a girl. It's not her boyfriend. She doesn't know him very well. But this is a new kind of childhood. I mean, again, the normalizing or minimizing sort of view of all this says, well, teenagers have always been interested in sex and they've always, you know, been sexual with each other and that's healthy and that's wholesome. I don't argue with any of that. But I do think the technology is new. I think that the behaviors on the technology are sometimes very manipulative and a lot because they're from behind a screen where we know people are not as accountable for their behavior and can be more aggressive and can be less ethical. And this is, again, borne out in studies. And so he says, send nudes. And this raises all these questions in our mind. Oh, well, why is he asking me this? Does he think I'm attractive? Does he like me? Does he want to get to know me? Does he want to be my boyfriend? All these kinds of things are going on in her mind. In this particular case, what it was that this boy wanted to exchange these pictures of her for alcohol, which he was going to trade the pictures to older boys for alcohol. Hmm. So this was, you know, an unflattering thing for her to hear and upsetting. And when parents don't know that this happened to a girl, or when even friends don't know, who does she have to talk about this with? Where does she share her feelings? What is there to guide her at this point? And I think that parents really need to be talking to their kids about this kind of thing.
My guest is journalist and author Nancy Jo Sales. Her new book is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist and author Nancy Jo Sales about her new book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. I had a friend who joked that, you know, kids don't get pregnant from sexting alone. Is there any evidence that engaging in sexting either delays or hastens the point at which teenagers begin physical sexual relationships?
The concern of my book is not really when kids have sex or even if they're having actual consensual sex. Of course, I'm concerned whether they're having non-consensual sex of any kind, but I think we are mislocating the problem here if what we're concerned about is just simply whether or not they're having sex. That's something for, I think, parents to talk about with their kids in terms of what they feel is an age-appropriate time for their sexual experiences to begin on a physical level. That's really for every parent and every family to have that discussion with their kids. That's not the concern of this book. The concern of this book is how social media is appears to be changing the ways teenagers treat each other, and even middle school kids treat each other in a sexual context, and whether they are being respectful, kind, and supportive of each other in their development. You know, it's not simply like, well, they're not having sex, so everything's okay. Mm-hmm. That's really a misnomer to me. It's what, and anyway, I mean, cyber sex is a kind of sex. I mean, a kid might not be physically engaging in intercourse, but she might be sexting and having very, sometimes very graphic sexual conversations with a boy on text and even exchanging naked pictures. I mean, I think parents also have to be aware of that and ask themselves, is that okay? And if they're simply doing that, is that okay because they're not having actual sex? You know what I mean? It's a little more complicated than just simply saying, well, they're not having sex, so that's okay. You know, I think that really what we need to be asking more as parents is, how is this culture affecting the adults that they're going to grow up to be? When they do encounter each other in a sexual context, and how are they going to treat each other and make each other feel, both physically and emotionally? And I do get into that in the book, in the chapters with the older girls. The book is divided into chapters by age, 13 through 19. And then some of the chapters with the older girls, there are girls who are sexually active. And the sort of sex that they are experiencing, as they told me, is also, I think, being very heavily influenced by the culture of social media, which is engulfed in pornography and in a porn aesthetic, which is just, you know, engulfing the internet and has been for a long time. But I think social media has really exacerbated and accelerated the exposure of kids to porn because it's just so accessible to them on their smartphones, you know. And if you had asked me, you know, 2.5-3 years ago when I started this research, what do you think of porn? I really would have had no opinion or even simply shrugged and said, you know, whatever you're into, it's up to you. Porn is not my concern. But I don't think any responsible adult who really understands how pornography figures into the life of underage children, who by our laws are not supposed to be allowed to see it, I think anybody could reasonably reach the conclusion that we have got to think about what we have to do about porn and its influence on kids' lives. Because with social media, your child, teenager, is going to see porn, whether or not they're actively seeking it out, because it's just part of what's on social media. There's a lot of very sexually explicit material. And even if they don't see it, which I believe they will at some point, and they tell me that they do, social media has a kind of porn aesthetic whereby selfies are influenced by this porn aesthetic where girls... you know, sometimes feel pressured or see the rewards that very provocative sort of pornographic-ish pictures get. And sometimes actual nudes get likes and followers and so forth. So I think that it's not only social media where this is happening. It's in the wider culture as well. There's a term, sexualization, that psychologists and sociologists use to describe this kind of culture-wide influence of, imposing sexuality too young on girls and the effects of it. In the 2007 landmark American Psychological Association report on the sexualization of girls, which I encourage every parent to read. It's in my bibliography in my book, a link to it, and it's available online. Really tells you in detail the widespread effects of this on girls, including low self-esteem, anxiety, depression, eating disorders, cutting, cognitive dysfunction. That's the one that really got me. Apparently, if you're thinking about being hot all the time, hot, quote unquote, it's harder to think.
You can't concentrate because you're so worried about how you look.
Right. There's a study that's cited in the report that talks about girls and boys being given a math test in wearing their clothes, and their grades, their test scores then dropped dramatically for girls when they were given the same test wearing a bathing suit, whereas the boys stayed basically the same, meaning that boys do not feel the same self-consciousness about their bodies, the same, you know, sexualized effect of our culture on them. They're more comfortable in their own skins.
So I'll cop to not knowing a whole lot about pornographic content, but I do know it is not typically a realistic depiction of human sexuality. Do teenagers understand this?
How can they? I mean, particularly if they have not actually had sex before, mm-hmm. and the sex that they see is porn sex. You know, in the chapters with the older girls, again, I'm thinking of what I can really talk about on the radio. Because
just watch
it gets
language,
very
but you can euphemize anything.
Okay, well, there are certain acts which are hallmarks of the most popular online porn. There are certain things that happen in the most popular online porn. There's almost like a roster, and they involve things that are somewhat, I would say, violent. The most popular online porn now is violent. This isn't an original observation with me. It's been written about in the New York Times, and there's been books written about it. So the most popular online porn is rather violent and fetishistic, and very often involves the degrading of women. And women who are styled to look like teenage girls and sometimes are teenagers. Hmm. You know, and the most popular search on Pornhub, which is the biggest porn site on the internet in 2014, was for, quote-unquote, teen. In other words, sex, which is often violent or degrading, depicting girls or women styled to look like girls or teens, you know. So put yourself in the mind of a teenage boy who watches porn on the internet, which we know many teen boys do, or on their phones, and he's watching this pornography which depicts treating teenage girls in this particular way. When he reaches the point where he is with a teenage girl in a face-to-face situation, is going to have sex with her, what does he think he's supposed to do? A lot of kids are seeing pornography as sex education in a way, unfortunately.
Is there room for girls to object to either, you know, expectations that they will act like a porn actress or that they will respond with seeming acceptance to a really graphic, you know, sexting communication? Can they say, cut that out, that's not what I want, without sort of risking their social reputation?
I was troubled and more upset sometimes to hear from girls over and over and over again when I asked that very question, well, why don't you simply say, cut it out, or I'm not going to do that, or that's wrong, or that's disrespectful, or forget it. You know, why don't you say one of these things to them when they do this to you or ask this of you?
Right.
And very often the answer was, because then you have no chill. What are you, a feminist? I mean, I'm just sort of repeating what the girls would say to me. What are you, a feminist? You have no chill. Oh, don't get so serious. You know, there's this kind of acceptance of certain behaviors, and to resist or reject or protest become seen as, you know, being that girl who just can't deal with stuff or isn't cool. And girls are not, girls are very aware of the inequity of this, of the inequality of this. Girls that I spoke to in my book are not lambs and victims. You'll see when you read it, they're highly analytical of all of this that's going on. They're very aware that this is an unequal situation and that it's wrong and that not respecting them is wrong. And they attempt to navigate it in all kinds of ways. But again, very often what they are met with are sort of reprisals, you know, like, for example, the girl who got or the threat of reprisals or actual. The girl who got asked for nudes, I said, well, why don't you just say, you know, you know, I'm going to tell your mom or, you know, something
right,
like that. She said that because anything like that could mean that you would get attacked on social media, which everyone will see and everyone has access to. He could take a naked image of another girl who's not you without her face showing and pass it around and say it's you and say you sent it to him. He could spread rumors about you. It's funny. Just this is just a little aside about the vernacular. They would often say he'll send rumors. You know, the real lexicon is spread rumors. That's what we would say, spread rumors. But they think of it as send rumors because it would be literally sending them on text or on social media. He'll send rumors about me or, you know, do this or that. And, you know, it's not only boys engaging in this behavior. It's girls as well sometimes sending rumors. Girls talked a lot about the betrayals that happen on social media with girlfriends, the kind of lack of trust that arises from, you know, these tools with which you can spread information about people or share information so quickly, and it goes around so fast, and they're very impulsive. I mean, teenagers, it's not their fault. They're biologically impulsive. Yeah. Their limbic systems are, you know, in flux, and they are impulsive. And so given this very impulsive medium as well, where you can just press the button and it's over, it leads to a whole lot of situations that they are ill-equipped to deal with, and no one is really talking with them about what to do about when they do encounter them.
You know, I'm an adult and my close friends are adults, so with the exception of, like, political spats that break out among other people during political seasons, the adults that I know that interact on social media tend to be really kind to one another and supportive, and if you don't have something nice to say, you just keep your mouth shut. I have to tell you, of all the things that I read in this book, and there are so many specific examples, this idea that girls don't feel like their girlfriends can always be counted on to have their backs, that is probably the most deflating takeaway for me from all of this.
Well, there's a misconception out there that I talk about a lot in the book that girls are mean, quote unquote. In 2002, there was a New York Times Magazine cover story, Girls Just Want to Be Mean. It was part of a media wave with several best-selling books that claimed that girls are somehow meaner than boys, that they have more aggression than boys, contrary to what was thought in the past. This has been refuted now in other studies and since then. And if you go on stopbullying.gov, which is the government's website about bullying, there's an article called The Myth of Mean Girls that talks about this. Girls are no meaner than anyone else. People are mean. People are kind and people are mean. What I'm afraid is happening is that that's a stereotype that I think, unfortunately, is used to dismiss the concerns and troubles of girls and to, you know, objectify them further. So I don't think that girls are meaner than anyone else. I do think that social media and you know, the remove of the screen, and again, borne out by studies, promotes a kind of meanness sometimes among people and aggression. It makes it easier to be mean and say mean things. And I mean, you could say girls are mean. On the other hand, what do you call the tweet that was sent by Donald Trump today, or yesterday was it? Where
I don't follow Donald Trump.
It was in the news, where it's part of the election because he sent two pictures. This is something like middle school kids would do, by the way, to be mean to each other. Something I would say in middle school, it was in keeping with what I've heard about middle school boys doing, as well as girls. He took a picture of his wife, who's, as we know, is a model, and put it next to what was called in the media an unflattering picture of Ted Cruz's wife, and said something like, a picture speaks a thousand words. In other words, my wife is hot, your wife is not. And this so struck me as talk about bad role modeling. It so struck me as, and what does it say to girls in this country about what is an acceptable way to talk about women and girls? And it so goes to the very central thesis of my book, which is that social media culture, this was on Twitter, social media culture is all about hot or not.
Yeah, and God forbid you commit the grave sin of not being conventionally attractive.
Yeah, or I mean, in whose mind? You know, I mean, attractive, you know, my grandma used to say pretty is as pretty does. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, attractive is there's no real, all these, you know, standards of beauty are very arbitrary, aren't they? So I think that Hot or Not, I'll just explain. Hot or Not was a social media site that was launched in 2000. And it, you know, had it invited users. It's one of the biggest, most successful social media sites, internet sites that's ever existed. Billions of users have used it. And you submit a picture and you say, is this person, other people get to vote, is this person hot or not? And when I started listening to girls all over the country talk about social media culture and what was going on, I sort of thought about that and thought, you know, it's kind of all goes back to that. Because what is a selfie? It's basically hot or not. What is any picture that you put on social media, even sometimes your thoughts, is this a hot thought or not a hot thought? And do we like it or do we not like it? And the person then is supposed to feel validated or not by the view of others about this. And I think this is giving up your power.
Journalist and author Nancy Jo Sales is my guest. Her new book is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Nancy Jo Sales. She's written a book called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. You can join our conversation at 800-933-5372. Let's speak now to Becky in Hearst. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I wanted to say thank you for taking my call, and I just absolutely, anytime you have a topic like this, I do my best to listen during the workday, because I have an 8-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son, and the stuff just terrifies me. But so my question is it just enough not to let them have the smartphone in the first place?
That's a great question.
I think it's up to you. You're the mom, and you have that mom GPS in your gut as a mom. And you know exactly what's best for your kids. And I think what you need to do is listen to it and have it guide you based on information that you get from my book or other places. You need to just follow your instinct as a mother and figure out what's best for your children. You know, I'm not a parenting expert, and this is not a parenting book per se. This is information that I hope that parents will find useful. But I do think that for parents who do have kids with smartphones, there has to be a conversation about what this is and how different it is, and finding out on maybe even on a daily basis what's going on social media, almost the way you would ask what happened in school today. You know, you need to know what happened on social media today. And you'll find sometimes simply by asking the question, which some parents do, but I think not enough, you'll you'll find that your teenager, your middle schooler has so much to tell you.
And it's probably, you know, when you talk about a conversation on a daily basis, I know you're not a parenting expert, but should that be part of the deal if you are going to provide a phone that, this is not a sort of a private device for a child's exclusive use, that mom and dad have the right to know what's up with that?
Of course they do. I mean...
But, you know, as a parent of a teenager, you know there are teenagers who push back really hard against that.
There are. But I think that there are ways to let them know how important it is for you to be involved in the conversation. And it doesn't have to be some big momentous thing that's scary. You know, it's just like you're fixing dinner and it's a conversational thing. It can be very casual, or in some cases it can be serious and you do need to let them know about dangers. I mean, one thing that we didn't talk about is predators, which do exist on social media. Again, a lot of parents are hearing and sometimes in the book, I feel I'm fighting against this normalizing or minimizing idea that, oh, that's just a moral panic and there aren't really predators out there. Well, there are. And there are, you know, it's just so common to have people who are not appropriate to talk to your child trying to talk to your child on social media, particularly anonymous sites, which I talk about in my book, like Kik Messenger, that I think parents just have to be aware of and have to warn their kids about, the same way you would warn them about any danger. You know, so it's a responsibility, I think, that we have to protect them from real, actual dangers that do happen in the world, and also to just, you know, be available to them to discuss what they need to know about and need to have guidance about on an everyday basis. You know, sometimes there was a mom, for example, who said to me, you know, I always know when my daughter has some problem on social media because she comes home and she slams the door to her room and doesn't want to talk to me. But, I mean, I think that's time to go and, you know, lightly knock on the door.
Right. Hey, what's up?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. 800-933-5372 is our number. John is on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have kind of a comment, something you said about 10 minutes ago, about guys who... I'm 18 years old, and I recently had a conversation with two girls about how they actually watch porn, too. And how there's an equal, like, I don't know how to say, not knowing what to do when faced with a real-life situation, such as the physicality of sex, as you mentioned, what's going on in porn. And these girls act as porn actresses in the physical situation. So there's, as much as guys, I just want to say, as much as guys feel, pressured is the right word, but pressured to do what these male actors do on these videos, and girls have the same pressure. Because I've been in situations where girls do odd things that I would that I'm not okay with.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point to make. Thank you.
He's absolutely right, and it's a very good point to bring up, and it's in keeping with what I found talking to girls, is that, it's not only boys who are seeing porn as sex ed. And what are boys seeing and what are girls seeing? Well, once again, girls are seeing videos in which they are often submissive. There's a lot of servicing of men and acceptance of violent behavior as hot, you know. So he's absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And I think it's important. And when you asked the question, Chris, about why don't girls object? Well, because they're being taught that this is what sex is as well.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Elizabeth on the line in Frisco. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Whenever you do subjects like this, it really interests me. I have a 13-year-old daughter. She does have a smartphone, and she does have social media. And I monitor it almost daily. I read her texts. I look at her accounts.
And I try to even follow a little further by looking at all, you know, the accounts that she follows and that follow her. But I still feel like things like this could get through without me knowing. So, and we do talk, but I wonder if there are there apps that show you, you know, history, or is there any other thing that a worried parent could do to try to make sure that their child isn't, you know, being caught up in this kind of thing?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Nancy Jo?
Well, first things first, you should be worried. And as a worried, concerned parent who's taking an interest in what's going on, that's the first good step, I think, towards having conversations. You're on the right path. You're also, I think, correct, unfortunately, in suspecting that there are ways that teenagers can hide their social media use. I mean, my book is not called Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers for nothing, because there, you know, as you'll read in the book, if you pick it up, there are all kinds of ways that teenagers do and will hide their social media use from you. There are apps that you can monitor them, but a lot of parents have asked me about that, and you should pick and choose whatever apps you like, but I think that they're kids, they're better at the internet than we are, and they're teenagers, so there's always going to be a way that they can and will hide their social media use if they want to. All the more reason why it's important to have a more like global conversation with them on an ongoing basis and a daily basis about what this is, what this means, how do you feel about it, what's going on, and how to respond when things happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Greg is calling from Dallas now. Hi, Greg.
Hi, guys. Great topic. Unfortunately, last year I was kind of a victim of this cyberbullying. Let me give you a little bit of background. I'm a public school teacher in one of the suburban districts in the area, and one of our other teachers in the district was caught with an inappropriate relationship, and he got the perp walk on TV, and there was a picture of the news. The kid took a screen capture of that, cut out that teacher's picture, put my picture in instead, made an Instagram account all about it, made other type of false things, and basically almost ruined my career. The kid was underage, basically got an early summer, got a slap on the wrist, first day of school, next day he's back in this class like nothing ever happened. Are there any laws that would make the parents culpable for providing this type of technology and then putting them on the hook?
What do you know about that, Nancy?
First of all, so sorry that happened to you. That's horrifying. It's not, unfortunately, that uncommon for things like that to happen in the lives of kids all the time, and boys and girls. And as an adult whose whole career is threatened, I can't imagine. I'm just so sorry. But I think that your anecdote speaks to exactly what I talk about in my book, which is that social media is, you know, engendering this kind of sometimes very cruel and irresponsible behavior. We hear from Silicon Valley so much about, oh, it's connecting us and, you know, making everything more convenient and making the world a better place. That's one side of the story. The dark side of the moon is that it's also enabling all kinds of behaviors that are not acceptable at the very least, and sometimes criminal. And the law, unfortunately, just hasn't caught up. The technology is very new. It's happened so fast. Smartphones came out in 2007. I interview guys at the Cyberbullying Research Center, the leading organization for cyberbullying research in the country, and they talk to me about how there's just not enough case law about this yet, because we're just not there yet as a country and as a culture, and it's going to take more lawsuits and more people, you know, bringing things to the fore to get people protected.
What, from talking to all the young people that you spoke to, are there things that they have heard or witnessed or experiences they've had that do cause them to sort of think a little more carefully for themselves about the ways they're using these technologies? You mentioned that they're not, these are not stupid young people, but are there things that you noted that kind of incline them to maybe take steps to be cautious about their activity online?
There are girls in the book who talk about trying to go off social media. There's every kind of girl in the book, I hope, in terms of social media use. There's even girls who argue with me or present an idea to me that social media is positive because they've found such positive experiences on it. Like, there's a transgender girl who said social media saved her life. Mm. She found, you know, support in the other transgender girls that she watched on YouTube. There's a girl in the book who became active in the Black Lives Matter movement through learning about it on social media, which it was a powerful political protest movement, which was started on social media by three young Black women. So this is not all about how social media is bad, nor is it about how every single girl is addicted and unable to escape. There are girls in the book who talk about trying to reject it and you know, making rules for themselves that are not imposed by parents or adults, where they say, look, today when we go, you know, on this outing together, or we go out to lunch or whatever we're doing, we're not going to look at our phones. We're just going to talk to each other. You know, so they are taking steps, some of them, in their own lives to try and curb their usage, curb their addiction, to interact more with each other face to face. But I think that the overarching trends and the overwhelming trends that they're experiencing are something. They feel like they're swimming upstream sometimes, you know, and parents feel like that too. And I think social media companies also need to be held accountable for some of this as well. You know, when the caller who just called, the school teacher, you know, that's something that really I think shouldn't happen. It shouldn't happen, not only culturally speaking and personally speaking, but in terms of the law. I mean, where's, you know, you want to ask, like, where's the social media company's culpability in all this as well? You know, very often they hide behind the First Amendment, and that's their defense, is to say, like, well, you know, we can't help it if people are just going to, you know, screenshot nude pictures of each other and forward them. We really can't help it. It's the First Amendment. But wait a minute. Let's unpack that. How is that the First Amendment to steal or rob a picture, particularly of an underage person, and send it to others and share it? How is that the First Amendment? And how does the First Amendment factor into that? I don't understand that at all. And I think that's something that, you know, case law just has to catch up with.
I'm guessing in the
and
last...
has recently in the Hulk Hogan case. I mean, I know we probably don't have time to get into that, but that was an interesting movement, I think, in the right direction. Some people would argue with me on that, but I think it's ultimately going to help protect girls and women.
The new book by journalist and author Nancy Jo Sales is called American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers. Nancy Jo, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.